Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Just down Figueroa Street here in Los Angeles, the E3 gaming conference is about to get underway. Americans spent more than $15 billion on electronic games last year, according to the NPD Group. A bigger and bigger chunk of that money is going toward mobile game apps. And many eyes were turned north to Cupertino today to see if Apple might debut a shiny new product on which to play those games. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Monday. It is the 6th day of June. The Apple faithful flocked to San Francisco today for their annual iPilgrimage. It's the kickoff of the company's Worldwide Developers Conference, complete with a keynote address by Steve Jobs. The conference is usually known for its new gadget announcements, but things were a tad more subdued this time around. Marketplace's technology correspondent Steve Henn has been keeping an eye on events for us and joins us from Silicon Valley. Hey, Steve.
Hey, how are you?
So, any surprises today from Apple?
Well, you know, the real surprise was there wasn't a surprise. You know, usually there's a lot of anticipation about some shiny, fabulous, beautiful new gadget that Apple will unveil. But, you know, this year, Apple released a press release ahead of time saying this event would focus just on new software for the Mac as well as its mobile devices, you know, the iPhone and the iPad. And Steve Jobs is unveiling the iCloud, Apple's new free cloud-based service. And that was all we got.
Well, I'm sure that there are some folks out there who are perhaps a little cloudy about the cloud. Tell us exactly what it is.
Well, for the last few years, it's been a big fad among businesses. And it's this idea that you can move all of your files and your data to servers in remote locations, and then you can access them from anywhere. Mm-hmm. For consumers, it's often been a hassle. It's, you know, difficult to get all of your music uploaded into a remote server. And Apple is trying to make this whole process as easy as possible. So if you own music in iTunes, you will be able to access it from anywhere. Same for books. Your photo roll, if you take pictures with your iPhone, will automatically be pushed out, not just to other Apple devices, but also your PC. And they're giving this away for free, offering consumers up to 5 gigabytes of storage. So it's quite a deal.
So if they're offering it for free, how are they going to make money off of this?
You know, one possibility is they could sell extra storage space. They're also offering a service. If you have a big CD collection and you've made digital files out of it, you can load that on and they'll charge you $25 a year. Personally, I really want to read the privacy policies on the service, because if you and I move our entire lives into the iCloud, they're going to know an awful lot about us. And, you know, that could mean lots of new marketing opportunities.
Now, I know the faithful were hoping that Jobs would unveil a new phone. So was there disappointment when he didn't?
Yeah, you know, I think there's some. And there's probably some disappointment among Apple shareholders, too. You know, Apple's unveiled a new phone at this event every year for the last 4 years. And it's actually really hard to overstate how important the iPhone is to Apple's revenue. You know, some folks estimate that for every 1 million iPhones they sell, they earn $660 million. Last quarter, they sold 18 million iPhones.
Well, Steve, that's got to spark some questions about why that is. You know, are they off their game because Jobs has been on indefinite medical leave since January 17th?
You know, most analysts I've talked to don't think so. And Steve Jobs was at the event today. He walked out to James Brown, you know, "I feel good." And he was his usual charming self. And they also have a really deep bench of executives. For now, I think many analysts aren't too worried about it.
It is, however, the first summer in a while without lines around the block, isn't it, at an Apple store?
Yeah, no, that's true.
All right, Marketplace's Steve Henn, thanks so much.
Sure thing.
Skittishness over a stalled economic recovery continued on Wall Street today. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Each year, 500,000 children around the world die from diarrhea caused by rotavirus. There is a vaccine, but many poor countries can't afford it. Today, GlaxoSmithKline and other drug companies announced they are lowering what those nations pay for rotavirus and other vaccines. This may be a case where a little price transparency helped save lives. From our health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Gregory Warner reports.
Just about a week ago, UNICEF published for the very first time the prices that it pays for vaccines for kids in poor countries. It revealed that Western drug makers charge the agency up to a dollar more per dose than companies in India charge. That adds up. Last year, UNICEF bought 2 billion doses. I reached Joan Howe of UNICEF by cell phone in Copenhagen.
We published the prices because we believe that transparency is a positive thing in terms of creating the environment where competition is healthy amongst suppliers.
Today, some of those suppliers, including Merck and Johnson & Johnson, said they'll cut prices for vaccines to UNICEF and other members of the Gavi Alliance. That's a coalition of governments, private donors, and drug companies founded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Richard Gold at McGill University is an expert in drug innovation and access to medicine. Gavi, he says, has been criticized for not using its leverage to reduce drug prices.
Their interests are not necessarily to deliver the most vaccines to developing countries. It is a combination of goals. One is, yes, we want to provide access, but one is we want to support our own industries.
Driving towards the lowest price isn't always the best thing for kids.
Nina Schwalbe is managing director of policy at the Gavi Alliance.
You want to drive towards a sustainable price, keep a couple of manufacturers in the business, so that you can also achieve supply security.
Schwalbe says she welcomes the discounts the drug companies offered today. They'll help narrow a $3.7 billion shortfall at the Gavi Alliance through 2015. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
In Bahrain today, dozens of doctors and nurses went on trial for treating injured anti-government protesters during clashes in March. Those protests also had consequences beyond the political. Another casualty was going to be the Bahrain Formula One Grand Prix. The race has been held there since 2004, and it's the kingdom's most profitable international event. But a few days ago, organizers said the event will now go ahead in October. Human rights groups are calling for a boycott of the race because of what they see as the government's repressive policies. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Since the protests began in Bahrain 4 months ago, 20 protesters have been killed and hundreds jailed. Saeed Al-Shahabi runs the Bahrain Freedom Movement in London. He says the Formula One organisers have failed to take the suffering of the people into account.
They should have taken the plight of the people, those who are behind bars in jail, those whose sons have been killed. It seems to me that money is the main motivation for those who have taken the decision.
There is a lot of money involved. The Bahraini government paid $60 million to host the event. The race could pump $500 million into the Bahrain economy. Bernie Eccleston, whose company owns the Formula One rights, stands to earn $35 million from the race, although the billionaire insists that money was not his motivation.
Nothing to do with money at all. Nothing in any shape or form.
His critics are not persuaded. A former world champion condemned the decision as money-grubbing. The editor of Formula One Racing magazine, Hans Seberg, says there seems to be widespread unease within the sport about staging the Grand Prix in Bahrain.
To go there and sort of celebrate there with, you know, a multi-billion pound sport with lots of glamour and just doesn't seem to fit. I think a lot of people find it pretty unpalatable, actually, and I have to say I agree.
But Professor Stefan Schmeinsky, who specialises in the economics of sport, says that millions who follow Formula One are focused on motor racing, not politics or even morality.
Perhaps one might wish that people in general took a more moral view of sport, but I think, sadly, it's not really true that they do.
He says staging the Bahrain Grand Prix makes perfect commercial sense, but the drivers may yet throw a spanner in the works. Given Bahrain's political volatility, they want a safety guarantee before they agree to take part. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, California will detail its plan to reduce overcrowding in prisons. It has to be done because the U.S. Supreme Court says prison conditions in this state are inhumane. California has the biggest prison industry in the world, but it is not adequate for the number of inmates, and the state can't afford it. As Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports, correcting the corrections system is easier on paper than in reality.
Over the last decade, spending on California prisons has jumped from 5% of the state's general fund budget to around 11%.
This is unsustainable. Without significant reform, we could see our state general fund spending 15%, 20% on corrections.
That's State Senator Mark Leno. He wrote a state law that would release prison inmates on medical parole, but only those who are permanently incapacitated and no longer pose a risk to the public.
In many cases, these individuals are comatose. This is a huge waste of tax dollars at a time when we don't have a penny to waste.
Leno says California could save millions of dollars, but the parole board recently rejected the first application for medical parole, even though the prisoner could not move anything below his neck.
If we can't put on medical parole a quadriplegic, I'm wondering who we can.
Of course, medical parole isn't the only path to reform. The state could save money by putting more people on probation rather than locking them up. Barry Crisberg with UC Berkeley's law school says housing an inmate in prison costs about $50,000 a year.
Putting that same person on probation, even intensive probation, would be $12,000. So you're saving an extraordinary amount of money by managing the non-dangerous people in probation.
Crisberg says overcrowding could also be reduced by shifting some inmates from state prisons to county jails.
We could divert low-risk, nonviolent, non-sex offenders to the counties, which is what Governor Brown is proposing and was done, interestingly, by both his father, Governor Pat Brown, and by Ronald Reagan.
Many of the state prison inmates would be transferred to county jails. Steve Whitmore, spokesman for Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, supports this approach in principle.
We have the capacity if we get the funding. If the funding is not approved, L.A. County cannot provide the necessary beds for the transfer of these inmates.
There's the rub. California Governor Jerry Brown has put forward something called the Realignment Plan. He says it could reduce prison overcrowding and cut expenses. The Realignment Plan would give more money and discretion to the counties. The governor wants to pay for his plan by extending taxes scheduled to expire. That idea is anathema to Republicans like State Senator Bob Huff.
Raising taxes at this time, or frankly any time, would be the wrong move. We're already one of the highest tax states in the nation.
Senator Huff warns of a public safety threat if thousands of inmates are released. He thinks the solution to the prison overcrowding problem is more prisons.
The Democrats in Sacramento have blocked construction of prison beds, even though we approved a $9 billion bond sometime back to do just that.
But law professor Barry Crisberg says building new prisons is not only expensive, it also takes years, so it would not alleviate the current overcrowding.
The federal courts would be screaming and hollering and holding us in contempt if the solution was just new construction.
California officials submit their plan to reduce prison overcrowding tomorrow. Once it's approved, California will have 2 years to put the plan into action, giving the state time to get its runaway prison system under control. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Coming up, when you think of Canada, what comes to mind?
Our image is becoming increasingly the image of Calgary, of the oil and gas sector in this country. And that's not always a positive thing here.
But first, let's do the numbers. A slump in airline and bank stocks helped drag the markets down today. The Dow slid 61 points, half of 1%, to close at 12,089. The Nasdaq dropped 30 points, 1 1/10% to finish at 2702. And the S&P 500 ditched 13 points, more than 1%, to wrap up trading at 1286. Shares of Citigroup crumpled nearly 4.5%, and Bank of America lost almost 4%. Investors worry the Federal Reserve may require banks to set aside more cash to cover potential losses. Meantime, an airline industry trade group revised this year's profit estimate to more than $4 billion. Last year, the airlines all told made $18 billion. Shares of Delta, United, and American all lost altitude by at least 3%. Bonds stayed flat. The yield on the 10-year T-note sat at 2.99%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve is scheduled to report consumer credit data for April. German Chancellor Angela Merkel joins President Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama at the White House for an official visit. And the Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions holds a hearing titled Drowning in Debt: Financial Outcomes of Students at For-Profit Colleges. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. There's not much left in the academic year for most high school seniors around the country. Some finals, a class party or two. Next step for many of them, college. For 10 million brand new high school graduates in China, though, this is Hell Week. 3 days of testing starting tomorrow. It's known as Gaokao, the National College Entrance Examination. These 3 days will pretty much decide who gets into the best schools, who will eventually get China's best jobs, and who will be the winners in China's 21st century economy. So, you know, no pressure. Our China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz has been working on a series about the Gaokao that you'll hear starting tomorrow. Today we feature Rob in conversation with my colleague Kai Rizdahl, who is in China on a reporting trip. They met up in front of a local high school in Shanghai.
Rob, I was here 5 years ago. We did the show from here talking about the pace of economic change in this country, right? We're back now looking at what has happened in the past 5 years, what has changed. One of the things that has not changed in this country in 5,000 years is what's going to happen on the day of the Gaokao at this high school that we're standing in front of. Give us a sense of what it's going to be like that day.
The Gaokao is by far the most important point in a young person's life in China. And inside this high school on the first day of the Gaokao, you know, we've got kids playing basketball and kind of milling around behind us now, but on the day of the Gaokao, they are not going to be milling around. They're going to be pacing nervously. Their parents are going to be outside waiting for them. Maybe the parents will have bought a hotel room for them just in case they get nervous. We just heard today that the taxi fleet of Shanghai is going to be burdened because all these parents have called taxis and reserved them. So that means the rest of us aren't going to have taxi service on those 3 days. So obviously this is a really, really important test.
It's basically rote memorization, right? These kids have been studying for years.
Yeah. So the Gaokao is at the center of China's education system. In that system, especially in high school, those 3 years of high school that Americans might spend, you know, taking, you know, your typical lib ed and science and math and everything and thinking about problems and all this stuff, you know, Chinese students are actually preparing for this test. I mean, high schools in China are glorified test prep institutions. The problem is that you're not spending that much time on actually solving real problems. You're busy memorizing correct answers.
Right. So play that out for me for a minute into what happens after these kids get spit out of the Chinese colleges and how they then think about what we're all counting on them to do, which is help China drive the global economy.
China wants to shift its economy to a more innovative economy, that's based on innovation in the future. It's going to have a heck of a time doing that if the students that they're graduating cannot analytically think about something. They cannot take data points and synthesize information. It's that type of creative thinking that will spur an Apple, that will spur things that are in Silicon Valley. Like, you don't have companies like that in China yet, and this is probably one of the big reasons why you don't have that.
So what's the government doing? Because they obviously understand what has to happen to get China where it needs to be.
Right. They're trying to reform things, but a lot of critics will say that China's trying to reform things much too slowly. And so more and more Chinese are getting more money, and the ones who can afford it are going to send their children to American colleges. And that way they don't have to take the Gaokao. They can go to an American university and learn all the things that they weren't learning in this Chinese education system there.
And then they come back here.
And, you know, a lot of the feedback I hear from business leaders here in Shanghai and Beijing is that these are like precious gems, the ones who actually go to American college and come back. They're the ones who everyone wants. But they know that, and so they're constantly poached by headhunters.
Let me get you back to this test real quick before we go. The kids from this school are going to do pretty well, right? It's kids in Shanghai and Beijing who are going to do well, and it's the kids from Wuhan and the second and third tier cities who aren't going to do
well. You're exactly right. I mean, we're in front of an elite school in an elite city in China. You know, most Chinese students are in these smaller cities, you know, a million, 2 million, right, that you've never heard of. And yes, they do not have the educational quality of students here in Shanghai. The problem is that if this is the best that China can do, that's really scary.
That's our China correspondent Rob Schmitz talking with Kai, who is on assignment in Shanghai. Kai's been posting photos and updates from his trip. You can read his latest report, a visit to Shanghai's marriage market, at marketplace.org. And tune in tomorrow for the first installment of Rob's three-part report on education. Today was the last day for the public to weigh in on a new pipeline to carry Canadian oil to the U.S. We already buy Canadian crude, but whether to pipe in a lot more has become a bitter fight in Washington. That's because the product going through the pipe is a controversial crude known as oil sands. And wouldn't you know it, those nice Canadians are playing political hardball to promote them. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
Let's play word association. I say Canada. You say something predictable.
Pancakes, maple syrup.
Their accent, like a boot. And ibuprofen, that's my favorite.
Alanis. And of course,
very polite.
Nice Canadians. Americans, but on decaf. Which makes this next one downright loony.
The government of Canada has crossed an ethical line.
Unethical? Environmental activist Graham Saul is with the Climate Action Network. He accuses his own government of playing climate bad guy around the world.
There was quite a coordinated effort to challenge a variety of clean energy provisions in the state of California, in Washington, in many other states, and in Europe.
At issue, Canadian crude, which is embedded in sand. And critics say it's one of the dirtiest oils in the world. It takes steam generators and other kinds of heat to get the oil out. All that energy means a lot of carbon pollution, and high-carbon fuels are getting banned around the world. So Canada's been pushing back. Marketplace has obtained internal Canadian government memos describing a, quote, proactive approach to ensure that the oil keeps a-flowing, end quote. We've got the documents on our website. Again, Graham Saul.
The Canadian government should not be a public relations arm of the oil industry.
Records show Canadian diplomats met with what they call like-minded allies, like BP and Shell. The oil sands province of Alberta has hired D.C. lobbyists.
We've been working very closely with the Canadian officials.
Former Illinois Congressman Tom Corcoran runs a group now under contract with Alberta. The group is called the Center for North American Energy Security. It's funded by oil companies, and it's joined a legal fight to let the U.S. military buy Canadian oil.
That reduces our dependence on the Middle East, North Africa. And those are countries which are not stable, they're not friendly to the United States, they're just the opposite of Canada.
Alberta confirmed the contract. The Canadian embassy declined an interview. To be fair, both sides lobby hard, and both agree that the oil sands have hurt Canada's reputation. Still, Ottawa is increasingly pro-oil, says Keith Brownsey at Mount Royal University. That is in Calgary, the home of Conservative Party Prime Minister Stephen Harper, who just won a majority in Parliament. So what's Calgary like? Well, this may help. It's oil patch money, says Brownsey. He's standing downtown.
You throw a stone, you're going to break a window in an oil company. Now, just to our right, if we look up 58 stories, we've got the new Encana building.
One of Canada's oldest oil companies. A block up is the Calgary Petroleum Club.
You go two blocks north of us, you've got Statoil, you've got Murphy Oil.
Point is,
our image is becoming increasingly the image of Calgary, of the oil and gas sector in this country. And that's not always a positive thing here.
Canada, the villain, eh? Calgary oil analyst Dave Yeager's long been sick of that one.
I've been a second-class citizen in my own country for all those years.
He says anywhere in the world, oil production happens to be non-aesthetic.
So you've got a ugly industrial operation right off the side of the highway in a free country with a jet airport. And it's pretty easy to get up there and look around and declare it awful.
But compared to Middle East producers, Canada may be the Boy Scout.
We don't kill anybody up here. We don't oppress anyone. We're not going to use the profits from tar oil sands production to build a nuclear bomb and annihilate Israel.
We can assume Canadian diplomats are more diplomatic when they promote the oil sands in Washington and beyond. But with what's at stake, they ain't playing softball either. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And this final note brought to you by the words ZOMG, or is that ZOMG, and Twitter Sphere, among others. The Oxford Online Dictionary added a good number of colloquialisms to its pages. We'll let you look up lappy and life hack. There's also roid, naked, which is the word naked, just misspelled and with an extra letter. Cyber Monday made the cut, as did bestie, which I think is related to BFF, all of which is, frankly, NSFW, because nobody around here is going to know what you're talking about. And that is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow slid 61 points, a half of 1%. The NASDAQ dropped 30 points, 1 1/10%. And the S&P 500 ditched 13 points, just over 1%. Our producers include Avishai Artsy, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this program, how a temp job answering unemployment questions inspired a short story writer's new collection.
I just wanted to answer the phone, and what I was getting were these glimpses of these lives looking for work.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.